Hello, I'm Ed Butler. Welcome to In the Balance from the BBC World Service. Today, as the warnings around the risks of climate change facing humanity are growing ever more shrill, we're asking whether there's an economic answer out there, perhaps staring the rich world nations in the face. It calls itself the Green New Deal. Well, some in the US are calling it that anyway. And with the rise of a newly assertive Democratic Party in the US, there's talk of it becoming official policy if and when someone successfully challenges Donald Trump for the presidency in 2020. Here is the Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez singing the praises of the Green New Deal on CNBC recently.
We need to save ourselves, period. There will be no livable future for generations if we don't address this issue urgently and on the scale of the problem. But we have runaway income inequality. We are at one of our most unequal points, economically speaking, in American history. But we aren't producing and we aren't innovating in the way that we need to as an economy. And there's this false idea that we need to put them all in a line and say, do this or do that. Do you care about healthcare or do you care about the economy or jobs? And then I started to realize that these are not different problems. These are all part of the same problem. And so to get us out of this situation, to revamp our economy, to create dignified jobs for working Americans, to guarantee healthcare and elevate our educational opportunities and attainment, we will have to mobilize our entire economy around saving ourselves and taking care of this planet.
Cue applause from many who support that clarion cry. The manifesto, backed by other Democrats, calls for a 10-year national mobilization to shift the US to 100% clean, renewable and zero-emission energy sources. A highly ambitious goal, you might say, given that fossil fuels currently count for about 80% of US energy consumption. In doing this, the country can reinvent itself, become an economic world leader and help fix greenhouse gas emissions all at the same time. That's the argument anyway. It's an eye-catching idea. It's certainly caught the eye of many conservative politicians, including the President Donald Trump. He seems to agree this is a ridiculous idea.
The Democrats are now advancing an extreme $100 trillion government takeover called the Green New Deal. But I'd rather not talk about it tonight, because I don't want to talk them out of it too soon. Because I love campaigning against the Green New Deal. I want them to make that a big part of their platform. No more airplanes, no more cows. One car per family, one car. Oh, you're going to love that in Michigan. Hey, how do you like the idea of one car per family? I don't think so. That's right.
A very wry President Donald Trump there. Well, he's mocking the ideas, but what actually are they specifically? Do they include one car per family policies? Let's find out. Joining me are our guests, Alex Douglas. He's a lecturer in philosophy at the University of St. Andrews. He's also the author of a book, The Philosophy of Debt. In Los Angeles, we're joined by the author and activist Ellen Brown. She's the founder and chair of the Public Banking Institute, a nonpartisan think tank devoted to the creation of publicly run banks. And in Washington, D.C., the director of the Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives at the Cato Institute, George Selgin. George, first of all, it's quite a thing, this, isn't it? A fairly niche bit of policy, macroeconomic theory, you might say, grabbing so much attention on both sides of the political aisle in the US?
Well, I suppose it's a niche thing in a sense. But if it really does cost about as much or perhaps 50% as much as our current level of government spending, that's a pretty big niche.
Ellen Brown?
Yes, agreed. That's a lot of money, but I don't think it's going to take that much money. And, it's been mischaracterized.
Alex Douglas, this is elevated philosophical debate being dragged, kicking and screaming into public discourse, some might say.
Yes, I think that one interesting thing that's happened on the back of the Green New Deal is that a huge amount of media attention has been focused on the question of how it would be funded. So as you say, technical questions of macroeconomics, as opposed to the specific bits of policy and what they're meant to achieve, people are being led to question how government actually does pay for what it does.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's dive into the specifics. Ellen, I mean, help us out here. The claims are that basically the United States can propel itself into a new technological era by means of what? A big injection of taxpayers' money?
No, not necessarily taxpayers' money. The original proposal that was put out in December said that it would be funded by a combination of government institutions, including the Federal Reserve, a national public bank, or a network of public banks. So a national public bank would be something on the order of KfW, or we had the Reconstruction Finance Corporation in the 1930s, which issued bonds, but they weren't government debt. They were bonds of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and then the government bought the debt. So the government was the buyer, not the seller of the bonds. And over 25 years, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation helped rebuild the entire country, funded World War II, our participation in it, and turned a profit for the government.
So this would be similar to quantitative easing, perhaps, that we've seen in recent years, only applied in an entirely different sphere. Rather than bond buying, it would be going towards public initiatives.
No, I think a public development bank would actually be recycling money of investors. For example, pension funds that are always looking for a safe place to put their money. These would effectively be government-backed bonds. But another part of their proposal was to use the Federal Reserve, and that would be the equivalent of quantitative easing, where you're just either issuing money directly to go into the real economy, or through bonds that would be effectively interest-free, since they would be held by the Federal Reserve.
I mean, the interesting thing here is the plan is calling, and this is not just for, you know, investment in tech, it's calling for upgrading all existing buildings for maximum energy efficiency, removing pollution and greenhouse gas emissions as much as is technologically feasible from manufacturing, agriculture and transportation. For good measure, the program is also calling for steps to expand educational opportunities, increase high-quality union jobs, providing health care housing. I mean, basically, it's a progressive wish list, which is not all entirely connected to renewable energy, George Selgin.
Yes, that's right. And that Trump mentioned a figure of $100 trillion. That may be high, but we have much more objective assessments of the cost of the Green New Deal. And they would run somewhere in the trillions of dollars per year for the duration of the program, which could be is supposed to be 10 years. But people wonder whether it could be done in that short amount of time.
But now it's true, isn't it, to say, although it hasn't apparently happened under the Trump administration, that Donald Trump himself, in his campaign pledge, was talking about a massive spending on jobs. He was talking about, you know, a big infrastructure spend. He hasn't seemed to push that agenda very hard, but that was part of the Trump agenda in 2016.
Yes, of course. The difference here, what the catch that makes this interesting, is that the proponents, many of them of the Green New Deal, are saying it can be paid for without having to significantly increase taxes, without having to have the government borrow a lot more, and also without any threat of inflation. Now, that is a bold list of promises, and I frankly think that these are not really possible.
You think it's pie in the sky?
Why? It's absolutely pie in the sky. Absolutely. Why? Well, the comparison that is frequently made is between the Green New Deal and, of course, the original New Deal.
This is FDR in the 1930s, during the Great Depression.
Right. Now, at that time, the idea that the government could expand spending a great deal without causing inflation, whether it financed that by simply printing money or otherwise, was not unreasonable, because you had at one point, by conventional measures, unemployment at 25%. So you have all these resources that are not being used. And there was a lot of scope for increasing spending and generating more employment and output without causing prices to rise. We're now talking about a situation where the unemployment rate is closer to 4%. We are certainly not, by any reasonable estimate, so far from full employment that we could increase government spending by trillions every year without putting pressure on resources, without creating the basis for some substantial inflation.
Right.
Maybe not hyper, but a lot of inflation, unless something else gives.
So the basis for the Keynesian model, as it's known, named after John Maynard Keynes, the great economist of that era, was that you only can get away with this level of reinflating the economy at a time of deflation or at a time of relative recession.
Of course. And Keynes, it should be said, as soon as World War II started, he was writing about how to take measures to prevent inflation.
Right.
So he understood that the situation was then quite different than it had been throughout the 30s.
Alex Douglas, what do you think about all of this? I mean, how does it measure as a reading of Keynesian philosophy?
Well, I think what George says is important. I mean, there are different sorts of inflation, but the kind of inflation that people seem to be worried about in this case is what's sometimes called demand-led inflation, where you have spending that's pushing the limit of the economy's capacity. And it's very true that when Keynes was writing in the Great Depression, you had so much spare capacity in the economy, unemployment at 20%. You know, it didn't look like you were anywhere near pushing the limit, even if you increased government spending.
So you were spending to make the economy productive again. It was the spare capacity in the economy that was the difference.
Right. You're just buying up spare capacity that nobody else is buying. So you're not competing with the private sector to buy resources.
But a Green New Deal would do that in the current climate.
Well, I suppose one hope of proponents of the Green New Deal is that there is spare capacity, but of a different form. If you have technological innovations, they might increase the capacity of the economy. They might increase productivity. You might find that there's a lot more space to spend in before you start creating inflation. I guess that's one concern. I suppose another concern is if there are other sources of inflation, cost push inflation, inflation that's there because corporations, unions, whoever are controlling prices, maybe if you could somehow dampen the effects of that, you would also create more slack.
Okay, Ellen Brown, fight back for us here. On behalf of the Green New Dealers, presumably they're going to argue that we need to redirect an economy that is woefully unincentivized to address the forthcoming challenges that climate change is going to present.
I would argue that we have a great deal of capacity that we're not using. The Congressional Budget Office in 2006 had projections for where GDP should be right now, and we are 10% below that. So we actually should be able to produce 10% more than we are producing. That would be $2 trillion a year that we could add to the economy, and that would be $2 trillion every year in order to create the goods and services that we have the potential to create.
But I mean, I suppose, listen, George, I want to bring you in. Taking all of this aside, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the great kind of leader, I suppose, the poster girl, the poster child of this entire policy, has herself acknowledged that we're not at war precisely right now. We're not in recession right now. This is a different situation. But she does argue that the United States has massively underinvested consistently over a long period of time, and that it can afford to reinvest, that now is a time when this type of reinvestment should be considered, because it's always taken a big push, usually from government, to launch new technological eras, and that's what we're up against when it comes to the issue of climate change.
Well, so there are two different issues here. One is, what should the government be spending on? And the other is, how much can it spend without provoking inflation? And second question is, I think, the one where the proponents of the Green New Deal are playing very loose with reality.
Well, right, but right now inflation's only 1.5% in the US. I mean, it's very low. It's below target rates. So they could afford to mess around with it a bit, couldn't they?
Sure, but that's the whole point. It's the question of what a bit means, because even Ellen said, well, we could spend $2 trillion more, given some estimates from the GAO back in 2006, some projections. But $2 trillion is not $3 or $4 trillion, and I believe those old figures from the GAO are not consistent with its current estimate of how much slack there is in the economy.
Do you challenge the allocation of resources here, then? The concept of the allocation of resources towards green tech?
I do, to the extent that we're talking about a $1 trillion increase in total spending, right? It's not possible
it's
to contemplate.
It's just too
much money. Yes, you can't contemplate the changes involved there without asking what's going to have to be given up. If it were a much smaller scale program, then you could just address it in terms of whether that's the best use of the money involved.
Alex Douglas, isn't climate change a challenge akin to a wartime emergency? There are those out there who would argue it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think the scale of the problem is absolutely comparable to a war. You know, it's close to an existential threat for some people. So there's no question that it should be addressed in that way. It's a different question of whether you could politically sell it in the same way. I mean, during wartime, people pull together and feel their collective sense of public purpose. That doesn't seem to have happened in this case. But I do think it's important to stress that there's so much uncertainty around what would happen here. So, you know, economists can make all their various projections. It does seem naive to imagine that, you know, it's not possible that you could have enormous inflationary consequences from adding spending on this scale. That's not a reason in itself not to attempt something on this scale, but it is a reason to demand that the people proposing it say what they would plan to do in that case. I mean, how would you deal with the inflation if it did start to show up? You're looking at something that is so vast that it's hard to see how simple monetary policy could be enough to deal with the problem. It's probably wrong, and I'm not saying that people who propose the Green New Deal are thinking of it in this way. It's probably wrong to think of this as something you can achieve simply by spending more. After all, the problem is, as you mentioned, an allocation of resources problem. So right now you have a lot of private sector spending on very carbon intensive forms of production. So you would have to reduce the spending on those things as well as increasing spending on things that you think we should be doing, development of green technology and so on. So this isn't simply an addition to the activities in the economy.
It's a
repression of certain activities.
Right. Okay, you're listening to In the Balance with me, Ed Butler, my guests, the philosopher Alexander Douglas, the author and activist Ellen Brown, and the economist George Selgin. Let's shift this forward a little bit, Ellen Brown. Looking at this, you have a plan yourself. I think I'm quoting you here, that we need a mechanism that involves neither raising taxes nor adding to the federal debt. We need a network of public banks. Tell us about these banks. What would they do?
It's basically mobilizing public funds for public purposes. It's directing them back into the local community, largely for infrastructure. So you could use that same model. Right now, bank profits obviously go to bank shareholders. They go into speculative investments. They don't go back into the local community. So this is just a way of using the potential of banks, which do currently create 95% of our money supply. It's created by banks when they make loans. So you can mobilize what we have right now more productively for local purposes.
Okay. George Selgin, what do you think?
Well, the question is, can we finance this massive program without either raising taxes or borrowing or without inflation? Now, Ellen's public development banks don't really provide an answer to that question in the sense of an obvious way in which we can avoid all three of those things. She mentions the 1930s and World War II era Reconstruction Finance Corporation, but what the RFC did was it got a budget essentially from Congress. It borrowed from the Treasury, but of course the Treasury had to be financed itself. And how did the Treasury get those funds? Well, it had to borrow or it had to raise taxes. So the RFC, if that's a model, it doesn't really tell us how we're going to pay for this program without ultimately having to rely on taxes, borrowing, or inflation.
Ellen, what do you say to that?
Well, I agree. We have to use the Fed for a program that's as large as what's being proposed for the Green New Deal. But I do not think it would create inflation, because we are actually in a situation of debt deflation right now. Everybody's in debt. Student debt's never been so high. Credit card debt's never been so high. Government debt's never been so high globally. Everybody is in debt. And so we need to pour some more money in there. I would say $2 trillion a year, according to that.
We need to pour more money in at a time when everyone's in debt. George?
I hardly know where to begin. There is a lot of debt out there, of course, but having a lot of debt and being in a situation of a debt deflation, or any kind of deflation for that matter, are quite different things. We have a lot of debt right now. We don't have a lot of deflation. The Fed is under its 2% target, but that's not deflation. So this is a long way from a deflationary crisis. And I'm not saying that we can't have more spending and afford some more inflation for that matter. But that's a long way from saying we can afford to spend trillions of dollars more every year without having to deal with it somehow by either raising taxes or cutting other programs if we're not going to then have too much inflation.
Alex Douglas, everything seems to be pointing towards debt in this conversation, one way or another. The US facing, of course, a gigantic public and private debt pile. What does it say about how people look at debt, do you think?
I think that it's important to separate out lots of different problems. There's enormous volatility in private sector debt, but we have to distinguish between the problem of there being a lot of private debt. Maybe we just think there's too much private debt and it's unstable and, you know, there are other consequences. It shifts resources away from the real economy. And the sort of problem that obviously requires more public spending.
Yeah, I mean, it also is to do with public attitudes towards debt, isn't it? And how we absorb that. I mean, so much of American political discourse, it seems to me, is driven by certain orthodoxies that exist on the left and the right around spending, around taxation, and around debt. And maybe they haven't changed as significantly as some thought they might in the years since the financial crisis of 2008.
Well, I mean, one thing I think I probably would agree with Ellen on is that the increasing debt burden is to do with how fast people's debts are growing relative to their incomes. And so you do need a national policy to help people's incomes grow faster than they have. But of course, that is almost by definition inflation, wage-led inflation. And the question is, well, what do you then do to avoid that becoming a different kind of macroeconomic problem?
But you could have a national dividend or a universal basic income that would supplement people's incomes without driving up the cost of goods and services, because it's not a burden on the employer.
I would like to bring in George, actually, this big question around this whole conversation and sticking to the climate change issue more narrowly than the wider ones of what levels of debt governments can run. Polls do show, don't they, that even on the right of US politics, there is now a shift. And this conversation perhaps is symptomatic of that. There is a shift towards talking more directly about climate change policy, about having a green policy. I noticed that there's things like a Green Real Deal, a new Manhattan Project. There are various things that Republican congressmen have come up with to respond to the Green New Deal proposal.
Yeah, well, there absolutely has to be a serious discussion about climate change and how the government should respond to it. But it won't be a good, helpful conversation unless in every case we have a clear idea of the costs involved, the sacrifices that will be made. It may ultimately be the case that the right answer is one of these programs that involves some substantial effort to cut emissions, among other things.
Alex.
Well, the scale of the problem, I think, is such that, and this is why I keep stressing the wartime analogy, this might be one of these cases where you just have to commit to doing something without knowing what the costs are going to be. I mean, every country that's gone to war has faced that political choice. You can't budget ahead of time for a war effort because you just don't know what you're going to have to spend.
Well, even if we were fighting a war, though, we would have to certainly think hard about a program like the Green New Deal, if we considered it a war, that involves not only efforts to combat climate change, but all kinds of other programs that are not directly related to that. So the danger is, for example, you might end up with a program that has so many things on it that you're actually doing less than you might by using more of the resources to combat climate change. So I don't think it's responsible to say, let's not worry about the cost, because then people will throw in all kinds of stuff. And that's the problem with our democratic process, that you end up with a lot of pork. That's a shame, because it means we have less resources to devote to the things we're worried about.
Which I think is a very good point, and it's the danger. And I think it's the massive political barrier to this is for the problem of climate change itself, for a project like decarbonizing the American economy, just transforming the nation's infrastructure, it might be that you need to get a blank check as a government to do that. And you can send up, you know, you can set up all of these radical new types of funding options. You can set up public banks. You can issue perpetual bonds. You can even give yourself a license to print money. But as you say, the problem with doing that is as soon as the government is given that power, it's going to want to use it for other things. And in fact, you've already seen it on the Green New Deal legislation that's been proposed. Why is healthcare on there, for example. Mm-hmm. Why is a jobs guarantee, a blanket jobs guarantee, which is a policy that, you know, I'm interested in, but why is that attached to the Green New Deal? Right. Well, because the Green New Deal is attached to these radical, interesting funding options that would permit an expansion at, you know, almost any scale for all of these desirable programs.
It's being the environmental cause is being used as a Trojan horse to essentially bring in all kinds of things that can't be said to be analogous to war by any stretch of
the
imagination.
Well, let me bring in Ellen, because that's the issue perhaps that people will say about this, that this is just a panacea, that just as critics would argue Donald Trump promised virtually everything in 2016, we've now got Democrats promising virtually everything under, and wrapping themselves in a green flag at the same time.
Well, I would say that's what's interesting about the Green New Deal is that it has introduced new ways of funding. It's made that an issue. Monetary policy has not been an issue for like 100 years. It never makes the mass media, but this has. And it's shown us possibilities that we didn't have before. And so it seems to me that if we have a way of getting money back into the system and of bringing the poor back up, I mean, that should be part of the platform, and that's what we should do, I think. Just try it.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us and covering all of this. The philosopher Alex Douglas, the author and activist Ellen Brown, and George Selgin, who's director of the Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives at the Cato Institute. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to Josh and Andy behind the glass for twiddling the knobs. More from In the Balance next week. Till then, goodbye.